hobby, and it took off, and they were in kind of awe of what they created. Oh, look at it. It's just sharing. It's like you lent an album to your next-door neighbor. They'll never get us. Then Napster brought some adults on board. Eileen Richardson. The day Metallica came was like the day we switched over from me being CEO to Hank Barry. Sean Parker. Hank Barry was this copyright attorney from Silicon Valley. Hank Barry. You could disagree with Metallica or agree with them in terms of their position, but for me the most disappointing thing about that whole episode was that it ended up being about money. It was sort of cast as a battle on behalf of artists everywhere. But artists everywhere didn't get any money out of it. Although Metallica did, because eventually we settled the case. Sean Parker. Lars and I have become really good friends. I was joking with him the other day that he's the only artist that actually made money off Napster. Ali Adar. So there are two lawsuits. One from Metallica and Dr. Dre, and one from the five major record labels at the time, both of them accusing us of vicarious copyright infringement, which essentially means facilitating the massive infringement of their rights on their copyrights. The labels filed a motion for something called summary judgment, and summary judgment means, Judge, you decide right now that Napster is guilty without hearing all the evidence, without going through a proper trial, because it's so obvious. And so, in those situations, the judge has various options. She could refuse that and go straight to trial. She could hear some arguments and then make a decision. Or she could say, without argument, yes, Napster is guilty. She decided to listen to arguments. Hank Barry. And so everything at Napster, all the 2 years of litigation, was around this question of preliminary injunction. There was never any kind of a trial. There was never any evidence presented in the case, none. Although there was this gigantic poster of Sean Parker's email. Hillary Rosen. It was Sean Parker's emails that really ended up having them lose those early court battles. Sean Parker, in an email. Users will understand that they are improving their experience by providing information about their tastes without linking that information to a name or address or other sensitive data that might endanger them, especially since they are exchanging pirated music. Sean Parker. Their point was that, well, we know all along that users were going to be pirating music. That was beside the point. The point was that it was totally fine for us to operate a service where users shared files. It was no different than Google linking to a file. David Boies. The use of the term piracy, I think, gave the judge a way of focusing on something other than how the technology works. Jordan Ritter. Parker's email presented in discovery. The fucking dick. Hank Barry. You know, it looks bad. Feels bad. It smells bad. David Boies. And as I tried to urge the judge, the question of whether the activity is lawful or unlawful is a matter for the courts to decide. It's not supposed to be decided by the exuberant outbursts of teenagers, no matter how talented they may be at designing software. But I obviously didn't get that point across adequately. Ali Adar. The labels painted us as bad actors, as people who don't have good intentions, and instead of responding with, we're operating under this area of the Copyright Act, and here's why it's legal, David Boies decided to make the, well, we don't really know what's being transferred argument, right? And the labels are saying, come on, Judge, these guys totally know. It's totally our content for free. These guys are totally facilitating this massive copyright infringement. Hank Barry. Boies is an amazing lawyer, but the bad news is he's not a technologist, and he was in the position of having to make a technological argument, and at the end of the day, David never really understood it. Ali Adar. And the judge, from the bench, without even going back and thinking about it, said, Napster is guilty. Hillary Rosen. The judge essentially said that it was not incumbent on us to tell Napster what was infringing. It was incumbent upon Napster to get permission for the works on their site. And that was a double problem for them. First, they had to obviously get permission, but they also had to have technology that could read the digital files so that they were not distributing infringing files. Sean Fanning. It was really surprising to me that we were being asked to function differently than all of the web-based search engines. Hank Barry. And then we were trying to deal with the injunction, and the outside reports were saying, you know, despite your best efforts, you're really not doing a great job on complying with the injunction. David Boies. The judge had said she did not want to shut the system down, and yet the scope of the injunction inevitably required the system to be shut down. Ali Adar. And, of course, the press was on top of this, and so the shutdown date was published everywhere. So everybody knew we were shutting down on a certain date. So before that date, our traffic spiked. Hillary Rosen. We won the first round in court, and they came to us and said, now we want to be licensed. They wanted these sort of blanket license fees. But at the time, there was no all-you-can-eat model. And when the Napster team tried to create one, the pricing that they had come to the table with was really unrealistically small. And we had refused to allow them to continue to operate while they were trying to accomplish this. And ultimately, they just ran out of time and money. Sean Parker. Having now launched Spotify, I can attest to what it means when you first think that you're going to get a deal done with the record labels, and you're 3 weeks away from getting those licenses and launching. You're really 2 years away. Hank Barry. And so we decided to stop the sharing. Jordan Ritter. So Ali and I are in the break room on the first floor, and I'm sitting there depressed, and he's sitting there depressed. I'm like, Ali, what the fuck are we going to do? Ali Adar. Apparently I turned it off. I have no recollection of actually doing that. I have no recollection of that day. Maybe it's one of those things I just shoved deep into my unconscious. I don't really know. I mean, I would be the person to do it. Jordan Ritter. Napster had to end because that's what happens at the end of every revolution. They gather up the leaders, they line them up against the wall, and they fucking shoot them. Sean Parker. I didn't care about Napster as a company. I just wanted the idea to survive. I wanted unlimited access to all the world's music. That was the public good. Jordan Ritter. And the idea lives on, but the progenitors of that idea have to die. Hank Barry. Afterward, we found out that there were all these open NAP servers still out there. And so the network was actually still working, even though we had shut everything off at our place. It's kind of a wild outcome. Ali Adar. You had all of the offspring of Napster. LimeWire, Morpheus, Grokster. Everybody's getting their content from all these other sources and not Napster anymore. So Napster doesn't exist, but millions of people are still using all these other services. Howard King. After Napster closed down, we had another 6, 7, 8 years of 50 other bootleg sites where you were able to get the same music. We did not end bootlegging. We lost the war, even though Lars was in it for only this one battle. Sean Parker. So Napster shatters into a million jagged little pieces. All of the users scatter all over the world to these decentralized services that take its place, services that they are incapable of litigating against because they have no corporate structure and no nation state behind them. Jordan Ritter. We blazed the path, and they would build cities on the soil stained with our blood. We had everything against us, and yet we still had the one thing that we can see now with hindsight. We had that social empathetic connection. Facebook taps into that. YouTube taps into that. Sean Parker. The story of how you take a completely unindexed hypertext world and turn it into an information resource that anybody can tap into. That's the Google story. And then, at the same time, you have the social story. This is what people are using to share music in their dorm rooms. And this is what people are using in order to connect with one another. And Napster is way early to the party, but in some strange way doing both of those things. Ali Adar, prior to Napster, it was all about who is the adult in the room. If there is a young founder, there is an adult CEO. Napster was the first case where you've got young founders and the VCs came in with the adult supervision, and it was an utter disaster. Jordan Ritter, I know why we failed, and it had nothing to do with the tech, and it really didn't have anything to do, in my opinion, with the industry. It was a political game. We didn't play it in a political way. It was a game, and we didn't know how to play that game. And Hank Barry sure as shit didn't know how to play that game. Ali Adar, now it's all about the young founder remaining the CEO. And why is that so important? It's important because nobody can understand their company, their product, or their service at a visceral level better than the founder. Nobody is going to care more than the founder. And now VCs understand that. And now the thinking is, hey, we'll just surround the founder with people that are adults who have skills in areas that they don't have skills. Coach them. Help them. Give them whatever resources they need, but they're going to stay the CEO. And that would have been a totally novel approach in 1999. It would have been completely ridiculous for any of us in that room to be the CEO, but it probably would have been the right thing. Sean Parker. I think at that point I was 19. Jordan Ritter. You know, the iPod would have eventually come out, and we probably would have done deals with Apple. And instead of Madonna getting prime position on iTunes, it would have been like local band X. Because we know what music you like. Because we know the ones that you download. Sean Fanning. From our standpoint, it was hard to wait. Especially coming from a generation where you can get basically anything you want instantly. It's frustrating when you want to make a change, and you see a fix, but you can't make it happen. So sometimes you push too hard. Sean Parker. You have to learn how to take it step by step. Even if you see the ultimate outcome, you've got to be willing to understand other people and how to sequence all the steps to get to that outcome. My end of the bargain at Napster, having gone from a programmer to helping run the company and handling label negotiations and the legal stuff, that part of it was a failure. My whole contribution to Napster, in some sense, was a failure. And so I didn't feel like I had finished the job that I set out to do until I got a chance to help negotiate the licenses for Spotify. That's when things kind of came full circle. We now have a service that looks basically identical to what we were trying to build at Napster. Hillary Rosen. Napster was very prescient, but everyone was greedy. Sean Parker. There was so little greed on the part of the people who worked at Napster. We would have given the company to the record labels. Like, you can just have it. We just wanted the idea to survive. We knew that we were the best chance that the record business had of a seamless and orderly transition to a future where artists and labels and publishers all would have been paid because we had every user all in one place. I made the argument to the heads of every record label that was willing to listen. They didn't listen to us. The dot bomb. Only the cockroaches survive, and you're one of the cockroaches. Wired's first issue predicted digital revolution, and it showed up right on schedule, engulfing the Bay Area at the start of the new century. Wave after human wave washed up in Silicon Valley and flowed to its most exciting outpost, San Francisco, the unofficial headquarters of the dawning web. It was kids and carpetbaggers, MBAs and coders, and they all wanted to meet each other, preferably with a drink in each hand. These were the dot-comers who worked for internet companies. The web was so new at the time, that the net itself was seen as a type of economic activity, like mining. Indeed, it was a new gold rush, and by the turn of the century, the entire region erupted in a speculative frenzy, with plenty of money left over for parties. It didn't make much sense to the generation of hardware engineers that had actually put the silicon in Silicon Valley. But the newcomers were having a lot of fun, and billions were pouring in. So why question it? And then one day in March 2001, the music stopped. Sean Parker. When you think about the history of Silicon Valley, if the first era is personal computing and what it took to establish personal computing as a ubiquitous platform, then the second movement is the rise of the web. Jameis McNiven. In 1991, I opened a restaurant in Woodside, Buck's, that has become pretty well known. In 1992, there was one mention of Buck's in InfoWorld. Bob Metcalf said he was having a power breakfast at Buck's. In 93, there was a mention in The Economist that John Doerr, whoever that was having breakfast at Buck's. Netscape had a lot of their early meetings at Buck's. That was the most important thing that ever happened here, because it allowed all of us to go online seamlessly. Peter Thiel. So Netscape comes along in 93 and things start to take off. Jameis McNiven. In 94, three TV crews came in. In 95, 150 TV crews came in. Peter Thiel. It was Netscape's IPO in August of 1995, over halfway through the decade, that really made the larger public aware of the Internet. It was an unusual IPO because Netscape wasn't profitable at the time. They priced it at $14 a share. Then they doubled it. On the first day of trading, the share price doubled again. Within 5 months, Netscape stock was trading at $160 a share. Completely unprecedented growth for a non-profitable company. Jameis McNiven. All of a sudden, everything broke open like in The Wizard of Oz. We'd been in black and white, and then it all turned into color. And that happened in 95. Jamie Zawinski. Netscape was the poster child. We were the first big IPO. The time when the industry changed from one thing to another, that was us. John Couch. The money was coming too fast and furious. I started interviewing people, and they started to say, oh, I'm going here for 2 years because they're doing an IPO. The Bill Hewletts and the Fairchilds and the Groves of the world had been replaced by 20-year-olds who were not focusing on building a long legacy. Paul Bronson. There's an old Silicon Valley lifestyle that comes off of the old NASA base in Santa Clara that was confused by the dot-com thing, right? They built satellites and stuff, and what was happening up in San Francisco just didn't make sense to them. They were like, what's their technology? They were like, HTML? It's not like you can build a company on that. And so they were like, they're not that hardcore. John Markoff. The San Francisco scene really emerged with the web. Tiffany Schlein. At the time, there were only 16 million people online. And a lot of them were in San Francisco making and creating this nascent medium. It was so exciting. Fred Davis. So why did the Internet get started in San Francisco? Why did that become the center of all the Internet things? Because we had the talent already sitting right here, from the multimedia industry. The multimedia industry drew a lot of artists and creative types and interactive people to San Francisco. So we were already building connected multimedia applications, but we had to build them all on a CD-ROM. They all lived in a tiny 600 megabyte universe. And now, if you could take the principles of HyperCard and interconnect everything, it was like, wow, this is amazing. This is going to change everything. Tiffany Schlein. It was so exciting. Jim Clark. From our going public in 95 to the year 2000, 5 years in there, there was an eruption of historic proportions. Fred Davis. Wall Street called it the new economy, and indeed it was. It was that big. Jeff Rothschild. I remember people used to talk about the new economy and the new rules. Those are the old rules, where you value the company based on margins and return. That stuff doesn't apply anymore. I think the people saying those things believe them. I really do. John Markoff. Silicon Valley began to move north. It began to be about software instead of hardware. It began to be about commercializing and disrupting normal business. Joey Enough. It was wave after wave of fortune-chasing opportunism, and it took different shapes. There was a distinct 1995-1996 era, which was much more literal. There was the spot, which was going to be the real world for the web. There was Amazon. They were very basic ideas, and some of them were completely inconsequential, like the spot, and some of them more world-defining, like Amazon. John Markoff. Silicon Valley had been an insular world dominated by engineers, and now it was touching the mainstream. Tiffany Schlein. The first Webby Awards were in March of 1996, and I started working on them the year before. I wanted to create something that was just as edgy and crazy as the web was at that time. John Markoff. The Webbies was doing something that was an imitation of Hollywood in Silicon Valley. Tiffany Schlein. That first year, I brought in Cintra Wilson as the MC, and she was the one who said, "Let's limit acceptance speeches to 5 words." And I was like, "That's a friggin' brilliant idea." She came out in a dominatrix outfit, and if anyone went over the 5 words, she would whip them. John Markoff. It was just so odd and off-putting to me, even though I am a judge. Joey Enough. From 1997 to 1998, it got to a level where there were so many companies with so many IPOs, the idiotic rhetorical question of, "If you know so much, why aren't you rich?" became overpowering at that time. How can we make a buck off of this when every jackass is getting rich? James McNiven. We had people coming into Bucks looking for work just so they could meet venture capitalists. We had a guy come in once, Nan Omo was his name, and he was an Eskimo who weighed about 300 pounds and was not very tall. So he had a spherical suit on and was walking around with a copy of the Industry Standard magazine. John Battelle. The Industry Standard was an idea I had at Wired. I was the editor at Wired that brought the business stories in. And in 97, I thought it was getting really interesting, but it just seemed like Wired couldn't contain all the stories. So I conceived of a magazine with a weekly cadence that was part economist, part variety. James McNiven. Nan Omo was looking at pictures of venture capitalists, spying the room, seeing someone, going up and slapping down something the size of an old Manhattan phone book saying, "This is the new Amazon. You've got to look at this." Chris Kane. At the time, everyone wanted to be the Amazon of fill in the blank. We want to be the Amazon of pets. Pets.com. James McNiven. He chased Steve Jurvetson out across the parking lot, so I had to grab him and threaten to drop him in the creek if he didn't stop. He goes, "Oh, but it's my dream." People came here with this big dream, and it was just off the hook. Chris Kane. So imagine there is more money than God, and it has no place to go, but there are a lot of cocktail napkins with things scribbled on them, and those are what are called startups. I'm being a little facetious, but not by much. The joke used to be at the time, this being 97 through 2000, the golden era, was basically all you had to do was stand at the corner with a cocktail napkin, and VCs would throw money at you from a passing car. I loved it. The dot-com scene was clustered around South Park, a seedy neighborhood park in San Francisco's industrial south of Market District. Wired magazine had its headquarters on the park, as did many of the most notable dot-com companies. Steve Perlman. South Park is this small little oval-shaped park that's largely grassy, except for a few swings and a couple of picnic tables. Eve Behar. I had either lived or worked on South Park since 1993. Artists and makers lived around South Park. Technical people at that time lived in Silicon Valley. Poe Bronson. South Park felt authentic for a while, this rustic industrial corridor full of garages, corrugated tin roll-up doors, no heat. Eve Behar. Then, during the dot-com boom, it went from being known as Heroin Park to having Japanese tour buses driving around the loop and taking pictures. Steve Perlman. You couldn't find a square foot of grass to sit on and cross your legs and eat your lunch. It was that packed. Eve Behar. It was the epicenter of the dot-com boom. We had e-groups, 21st Century Internet, which was a VC firm, big words. We had pets.com a block away. Scott Hassan. I was mostly doing e-groups at the time, and Yahoo purchased the company for $450 million, which is not bad for 2 or 3 years of work. Eve Behar. All these companies were right there. People have always been looking for where the Internet is, and for a little while, the Internet was at South Park. Poe Bronson. Masses of young people who didn't know even why they were coming were coming. There was this sense of a whole generation just showing up here unannounced. And I wanted to tell the little people's story. So I was doing things like staying at the airport. And in the middle of the night, at 2 in the morning, the flights from different countries would arrive. And I would stand outside customs and I would look for people who looked like they didn't know what they were doing and say, "You've heard of Wired, right? I'm a Wired writer." I met some people like that, and I would follow these people on and off. Just follow the string for a while. Patty Barron. Back then, pretty much everyone that you met was like, "Oh, I'm in the tech industry," or, "I'm trying to get into it." It was like the thing. At first, we would go to these boring networking events, but everybody still wanted to go because it was like, "Oh, look, there's Craig Newmark from Craigslist." You know, like, how exciting. Poe Bronson. I thought I was telling this story about the little people. They're just getting chewed up alive. They're living on each other's couches, and they're not having any fun. And relationships are being broken up, and the parents aren't talking to them. And they can't even get a job in this thing. And I'm telling this story, and then there's this guy, Ben Chu. He was just another naive kid that I just found. Another naive kid from Taiwan who had no real chance. He and his six-person startup had no chance. Then all of a sudden, Ben Chu has been bought out for $35 million. I couldn't fucking believe it. I was like, this really is insane. Ev Williams. There was a lot of talk about who was getting funded and who was doing biz dev deals with who, and then, of course, the parties and the events. What's interesting is how that information came out, because there wasn't any social media at all. There was a nascent blogging world being built, just a handful of hand-rolled weblogs. This was before they were called blogs. Biz Stone. I was reading evhead.com and really impressed by the guy. Totally in sync philosophically with his thinking. I was completely sold on this idea that blogging was the true democratization of information. Peter Thiel. Launch parties became so important that someone put together an exclusive email list that published rankings of the various parties going on that day. Patty Barron. So I had this website, sfgirl.com, and pretty much everybody in the tech community knew about it. We listed all the dot-coms. We had community forums where people involved in startups would come and discuss what was happening. I don't know who decided to start having these launch parties, but that became a thing. Going to dot-com parties. The new dot-com would get all this publicity, and the more extravagant their event was, the more publicity they'd get. Ev Williams. Every night there was a party to go to where you could drink for free and eat for free, and there would be lots of young people, half of whom were brand new to town. Patty Barron. The more extravagant the event was, the more publicity they'd get. The more write-ups, the more people talking about them, like, I heard that blah 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 had pig races at their party, and this or that party had 10-foot ice sculptures and vodka luges and things like that. It just became a thing to one-up the last party and get attention. Ev Williams. I remember leaving some party with a bottle of champagne. It was like, you're leaving? Have a bottle of champagne. In those days, it wasn't a ridiculous gift. Jameis McNiven. There was a guy, the name of the company was Pixelon. He raised $15-18 million, had no product, went to Las Vegas, hired The Who, and I think Kiss. He basically just threw away all the money and put all his friends up at a hotel until the regulators came in and arrested him. It's like, that wasn't unusual. Patty Barron. There was a party where the Bare Naked Ladies played, and then we went to another party and the B-52s played. Max Kelly. There was a company called Icebox Studios, which was doing online animation series. They did this one show called Mr. Wong, which was amazingly, psychotically offensive. This company got funded, had no revenue, had high production costs, and they still threw this huge bash. Run DMC played. There were all these celebrities that they invited, and they had a walk where photographers were out there, just like a movie premiere. The whole shebang went on for like 12 hours. Chris Kane. Oh, God, the parties were fabulous. I mean, parties every night. Jameis McNiven. Draper Fisher Jurvetson once rented one of the biggest buildings in the world, Hangar 1 at Moffett Field. It was where the USS Macon Zeppelin was, and filled it with amusement park rides. There must have been 11,000 pounds of shrimp, and it was raging. Barbara Ellison, Larry's ex-wife, used to throw parties with zebras and elephants and giraffes. There was a party once that had army tanks driving around with naked women. One guy had a huge party and hired these four party girls to just walk around completely naked in Woodside on a Sunday afternoon. Poe Bronson. There was always this high-low tension that was always trying to make you feel like you hadn't totally sold out. Like you add some funk and you get rid of the guilt. Like everybody would wear a tuxedo with sneakers or serve Kobe beef on a cheap old napkin. It was some form of apology or some sort of a desperate cry to not be just about the money. Jameis McNiven. It was all very interesting, and we were younger then, and we thought it would go on forever. John Battelle. There was this sort of reality distortion field around the entire internet. That was like, everything is changing, and I want a ticket to the change. Where do I buy a ticket to the change? And so, if you wanted to buy a ticket to the change in, say, retail, you would buy a share of Webvan. If you wanted a ticket to the change in travel, you would buy a ticket to Expedia or Priceline. Joey Enough. Day trading on the internet with E-Trade is just a matter of clicking something to buy or sell. So it brought this Twitch element to retail investing. And if you're me, a fucking idiot who doesn't know anything about the history of the market, for all you know, you might as well be playing Dig Dug. Carl Stedman. So you have people investing in ideas. Some of them good, some of them bad. And because what you get in a frenzied economy that is in search of IPOs are ideas like Pets.com. They were willing to ship you a 40-pound bag of dog food for no shipping fee at a tremendous discount. It made no sense. There was no underlying business plan. It was this tulip mania. It was the exuberance, irrational exuberance. Ev Williams. This company would IPO and that company would IPO. We were all swept up in it.
Tiffany Schlein. There was so much talk about IPOs that we had an initial pumpkin offering for Halloween. Everyone came out to South Park. I still have all the swag from that. It was very funny. It was a ridiculous time.
Carl Stedman. My marker for a long time was Paris, 1968. It was this time when students and workers, and especially the farmers and to some extent citygoers, joined in this general strike. And if you read the accounts from the people at that time, they felt that anything was possible. And in the mid to late 90s, there was also that sense that there's just this miracle happening. And anyone with a sense of history understood that we were in a moment which was not sustainable. Ev Williams, it really felt like a moment. Joey Enough, there was a point that you could buy a stock and the next day it would be up 4 times in value. Jim Clark, Silicon Graphics was never anything more than 10 times earnings. In 2000, there were companies trading at 100 times earnings. Jeff Rothschild. There were people who invested everything in these growth stocks. And they were buying companies at 100 times earnings, waiting for it to go to 200 times earnings. Or in many cases, they were buying things at 300 times earnings, hoping it would eventually be 500. Max Kelly. These kids were going crazy and trying to figure out how to leverage their shares and all this other stuff. And of course, they all got fucked. Carl Stedman. At Suck, we celebrated the craziness because we were living in a world that was not going to exist again. That was my take at the time, because it was not as though people were going to listen to reason. Max Kelly. All of them almost universally got fucked, as I recall. Patty Barron. We kept hearing, oh, the dot-com bust is coming. But we were like, what does that mean? We didn't really know. Was everyone going to lose their job and be begging on the streets? We didn't really have any idea. Scott Hassan. It was a super hot time in the valley. Things were really hopping, and there was so much money flowing in that I think the VCs were just very inundated by money, too, and they needed to actually get that invested, because they can't take a carrying fee if it's not invested, and so they have to invest it. Jameis McNiven. Just before the crash, John Mumford at Crosspoint Ventures, who had raised a $1 billion fund, said, you know, I can't responsibly invest, so I am not going to do my fund. I am going to give my investors their money back. And all these other VCs are going, no, no, you can't give the money back. That wrecks the whole game. That's when the money dried up and the ideas stopped and everything ground to a halt. Chris Kane. Also, people started realizing that it was kind of a circular economy, that it was the VCs funding companies that invested in other companies that were bought by other companies. Jeff Rothschild. I was skeptical about the valuation of these companies because, you know, I thought about it and said, well, the only way they could continue to be this valuable is if other people were acquiring them, and that can't go on forever. You eventually don't have any more bigger fish. Companies were getting such big valuations that nobody could acquire them. Chris Kane. It was a circle jerk. It was all the companies in Silicon Valley giving each other the same dollar and having it go around the room. And so once the tap turned off for one company and you multiply that across the whole ecosystem, the disaster was almost preordained. Jeff Skoll. In January 2000 was the merger between AOL and Time Warner. So I remember Pierre and I sitting in the little conference room when we hear that news, and Pierre, who is super wise, said, it's probably going to be the crash of the internet. And I was like, why? And he said, well, this is the first time you are having Yankee dollars buying Confederate assets, right? And up to now, those Confederate assets have been priced at whatever they've been priced at because of a dream and a prayer. But now you have real hard assets being placed against those numbers, and it's going to crash the NASDAQ and all that. And he was right. Ev Williams. The stock market crashed in March, but it wasn't immediately obvious that everything was over. There was a suspension of disbelief. It was like Wile E. Coyote running off a cliff. He's still running for a while. In fact, we raised the first money into Blogger in April of 2000. Biz Stone. I was like, damn it, why didn't I do that? I was so blown away by Blogger. I was like, blogging is going to be amazing. I just got the shivers thinking about all the people who weren't coders who would now be able to have a voice on the internet. Ev Williams. We raised $500,000 and hired 7 people. We assumed we could raise more later in the year, and then as that money started running out and it got to be the end of the year, we realized, oh, there's no more money. Brad Handler. Then in March of 2001, everything just started to implode. Companies were failing. Brad Handler. Webvan came and went. Pets.com, whoever thought that was a good idea, went. The Globe had the highest run-up and then a year later was bankrupt. John Markoff. Pets.com and Webvan, nobody believed in those. They had the air of excess right from the start. Andy Grignon. We were doing stupid stuff, Pets.com and Webvan and Excite at Home. It was the early development of the service economy. Jack Boulware. It was crazy. All this money that was pouring into the Bay Area, ridiculous schemes like Beans.com, Webvan, Cosmo, and everybody would profit from it. Limo drivers were accumulating fleets of like 10 or 20 cars. The strippers were all buying houses. Then boom, all of a sudden it was gone. People were left looking at one another. Did we just get played? What happened? Paul Bronson. I was having fun roasting this place, then I met Ben Chu. I can't even remember what he was doing, but I saw all that money and I'm like, maybe it's somewhat for real. And I lost my critical mind in there. Brad Stone. A conventional wisdom formed right after the crash that these companies were bad or ridiculous or excessive, and I think that's unfair, because we've seen all these businesses play out by and large. The dream of Pets.com seemed ridiculous when the company went bankrupt, but it certainly doesn't now. Chewy.com was just sold to PetSmart. It was the biggest e-commerce sale in history. John Markoff. So, was Webvan ahead of its time? Well, there's this experiment called Instacart, which seems to be working. Brad Stone. They weren't bad ideas. The ideas were sound. Ultimately, the market liked those ideas. It was the wrong time. It was too early. Andy Grignon. Those ideas became successful later on. Amazon ultimately birthed out of that thinking, but we did a lot of stupid things. We spent a lot of money on making things that weren't ever going to be profitable. Fred Davis. There were a lot of bad companies that needed to go. My joke company is eggsbymail.com. It just isn't a good idea to start with. So shaking them out would be good if it was a correction. But it wasn't. It was a complete turning off of the monetary faucet.
Mark Andreessen.
In the dot-com crash, all the dot-coms go out of business. Then all of a sudden, all the big companies were like, oh, this internet thing? We don't have to worry about it after all. If the dot-coms are going away, we were right. This internet thing isn't going to be a big deal, and so we can put all these projects on hold or slow them way down. Our market just cratered. Chris Kane. The speed with which it happened was the shocking thing, and it happened when Atari collapsed, too. That's the one thing about Silicon Valley. Damn. When that bomb goes off, it all happens in a hurry. Everyone talks about how fast Silicon Valley grows. This whole, a rising tide lifts all boats thing. But people forget the opposite is equally true. When the tide goes down, everybody goes down. Brad Handler. Seeing a company like Exodus go to zero, that was a little sobering. Ray Sidney. Exodus is the data center where Google had its first server farm. It was also hosting machines from Inktomi, which was another early search company, and from Yahoo. All the big names. Chris Kane. It's, oh my God, the bubbles burst. Silicon Valley is ending. Everyone forgets that 2000 is the second time that the bomb went off in Silicon Valley. The first time was 83-84.
Mark Andreessen.
Then 9/11 happened, which was obviously tragic, and in addition to being tragic, had the effect of shutting down any business that was hanging on in our industry. Basically, 9/11 was it. Business just shut down. Mike Slade. So 9/11 happens on a Tuesday morning, right? And the world's on fire, right? I went to Apple and we were all sitting around and Steve looked at me and he goes, "There's going to be a war." People were like, "Should we even bother with this meeting?" People weren't really sure that we would function as a business. I'm serious. What the hell, right? It was weird. Fred Davis. So after 9/11, the market opened and every freaking man, woman on the street dumped all their tech stocks. I had to go into the office and fire 30 people the next day because everything was gone. Eve Behar. Life was easy and beautiful and happening, and recent college graduates from the Midwest and East Coast had gotten hired at great salaries. And then suddenly there was no work in San Francisco. People's dreams were shattered. Patty Barron. When the towers fell, my boyfriend, who is now my husband, and I were in Europe for a month traveling around. I was like, "Let's go on a trip, and when we come back, we'll get new jobs, and we'll just keep making money and doing whatever." But when we came back, he could not get a job to save his life. John Markoff. It was like a neutron bomb went off. It all happened incredibly quickly. One day the sky was the limit, and then the sky wasn't the limit, and it just came crashing down so very quickly. Jamie Zawinski. That's all nonsense. It's all blown out of proportion. There were a bunch of people who counted their chickens before they were hatched, who found out that they didn't make as much money as the lying liars told them they would. I knew a few people who bought their expensive condo and filled it with ridiculous furniture by leveraging money that didn't show up. Then the tax bill comes due and they're fucked. Fred Davis. I needed a couple more million bucks to lend my company because the bubble burst in 2000. And then I had a huge number of Ask Jeeves shares. So I go to my broker and he says, "Don't sell the shares, just borrow on margin and lend it to the company. It's a small amount." And he said, "You're totally protected because Jeeves was trading around $14. It has $7 of cash in the bank, so it'll never go below $7. Okay, great. But after 9/11, Jeeves went to 80 cents because people were panicking. 2 years later, it sold to Barry Diller for $35 a share. But because I had such a large position in it, I couldn't last until the buyout happened. Jeff Rothschild. So, you know, a lot of people got greedy, and maybe they can blame their brokers, but a lot of people did stupid things. They would exercise their stock options and then hold before they would sell, because they were counting on a higher price. So they might exercise a stock option for $100 a share, at which point they owe $50 a share in taxes. But if the stock price falls to $10 a share, when the tax bill of $50 a share comes due, you sell your house, you sell everything you've ever owned, and you will still be working for the IRS for the next 10 years. This happened to a lot of people I know. Fred Davis. I saw tens of millions of dollars disappear in one day. Jamie Zawinski. Okay, well, some very bad money decisions there, but I'm sorry, there was no collapse. There were inflated promises that didn't come true. It's not like property prices have ever gone down in San Francisco, ever once. Maybe for a minute after the last earthquake. Eve Behar. Maybe they were stupid dreams. Stock options that looked like they were worth millions. Recent college graduates thinking that they had made it and it was real easy. Patty Barron. We ended up leaving because my husband got a job in Utah. We were like, "Oh, God, we don't want to go to Utah. That sounds horrible." But you're going to go to where you're going to get a job. And that was kind of our exit from San Francisco. Eve Behar. People had to go home. 100,000 people left the Bay Area at that time. John Markoff. It really cleared out. Patty Barron. The world was a changed place. The mood was totally different. It was very somber, very quiet. No emailing, no people calling. I did keep sfgirl.com going until we left, but the site was basically about parties, and the mood was not the mood to be throwing parties of any kind. It had run its cycle. John Markov. The best thing about the collapse was all of a sudden you could drive on 101 and 280. Eve Behar. Traffic went from being absolutely completely impossible to being a breeze. It suddenly was a pleasure to be on the freeway between San Francisco to Silicon Valley. Aaron Sittig. You'd go to dinner at a restaurant and you'd get amazing service, and so you'd strike up a conversation with the server and find out that they were like an unemployed physics PhD who had just gotten a degree from Stanford. It was really rough. Everyone was just scraping by. Sean Parker. It went from being the center of the universe and all these bright-eyed, bushy-tailed people showing up from all over the country and reading Wired magazine cover stories about all of the young people who were emigrating to Silicon Valley to seek their fortune, to nuclear winter. Only the cockroaches survive, and you're one of the cockroaches. Mark Pincus. San Francisco was a shell of a city, and all these people had come in, and they left, and all these companies had collapsed. It was very drastic. Poe Bronson. All this money was gone, and then there were investor lawsuits, and then there wasn't even the money to fund the investor lawsuits. It just all kind of became barren. Sean Parker. And then after the dot-com bust, there was a feeling everything that there was to be done with the Internet had already been done, that there were no new ideas, that nothing new could ever come out of the consumer Internet. Mark Pincus. I'm sure it was only in my head, but I felt that there were about 6 people that I knew who were interested in doing anything in the consumer Internet, and we all kind of went to the same 2 coffee shops in the Mission. Sean Parker. So you're just sort of like hanging out with the other cockroaches, and it's terrible. There's no sense of enthusiasm. It's the most unglamorous, unsexy, miserable thing you could be doing. No one understands why you're doing it. Certainly investors didn't. Nobody my own age did. Mark Pincus. No one in San Francisco had any interest or even understood what you were talking about. If anything, they might be a little annoyed. Ev Williams. The thing that people missed was that it was the financial bubble that burst, not the Internet. This whole time, usage of the Internet continued to climb dramatically. Aaron Sittig. Everyone who had come to pursue a quick fortune left, and the only people still around were people who believed in the real promise of what the Internet could provide, what technology was capable of doing for people. A lot of the cynicism that happens during flush times went away, and the attitude changed. There was a lot of mutual support and looking out for each other, hoping that someone would find a way to break through and succeed. Sean Parker. So you have this really narrow population of people who believed. The only people who got through that period were the ones who were truly passionate, or the ones who had incredible capability. Andy Grignon. The pioneers got the arrows, and collectively the hive watched. They take the lessons learned and start to make profitable companies based on them. Ev Williams. I was a coder at the time, so I was like, well, I'll just build shit. And that was kind of fun for a while. I just didn't leave the basement. Sean Parker. Everybody else got annihilated and left.
The Return of the King. I came, I saw, I conquered. The dot-com boom was cold comfort to the Valley's traditional hardware business. While NASDAQ was on a steep climb, Apple was facing bankruptcy. By 1997, Macintosh had sunk to a pathetic 2% share of the market, and Microsoft had the rest. That was the year Jobs finagled a return to the company, which he had founded 2 decades before but had never actually controlled. This time, he would be firmly in charge. The first thing that the older and wiser Jobs did was launch an advertising campaign, Think Different, which flattered the Apple faithful with comparisons to Albert Einstein, Buckminster Fuller, Pablo Picasso, and the like. Then he launched a new computer, the iMac, which piggybacked on the vogue for all things Internet. The third launch was a clever new product aimed at the Napster generation. The iPod was a way to put an MP3 in your pocket. Apple's update of Sony's venerable Walkman idea proved to be a game-changer, a completely new direction for the company. Last in the computer marketplace, Jobs was the first to realize that the whole of the consumer electronics industry was ripe for plunder. Apple was back. Steve Jobs was calling the shots, and this time it really would be different. Larry Ellison. Back in mid-95, Steve was finishing up Toy Story at Pixar and running Next, the computer company he founded after he left Apple. Apple was in severe distress. It had gone steadily downhill during the 10 years of Steve's absence. The problems were now so serious that people were wondering if Apple would survive. It was all too painful to watch and stand by and do nothing. Trip Hawkins. At that period of time in the 90s, they really seemed like they were up the creek without a paddle. Michael Dewey. What was keeping Apple alive was the Apple II. Luckily, the Apple, because of its education market, kept selling year after year. That's what propped up the company until Steve Jobs came back. Larry Ellison. We used to go for these long walks in Castle Rock State Park over by the coast. It cost $5 billion to buy Apple in those days. It was run by a fellow named Gil Amelio. I had raised the money. I was going to give Steve 25% of the company, and we were going to take it private, and he was going to run it. And Steve said, "You know, Larry, I think I figured out a way I can get control of Apple without you having to buy it." I'll never forget this conversation as long as I live. I said, "Okay." And then he said, "Yeah, I think I can get them to buy Next Computer, and I'll go on the board, and eventually the board will recognize that I'm a better CEO than Gil Amelio, and I'll become CEO." Steve Wozniak. We bought Next because they had a real operating system, and we desperately needed an operating system. Steve didn't understand what an operating system was, or what its importance was when he built the Mac. John Rubinstein. So I got to Apple in early 1997, right? And Steve hadn't come back yet. I came in as part of the restructuring that Gil Amelio was doing. They acquired Next as part of that, so I kind of came into Apple as part of the acquisition. Larry Ellison. And then I went on the board. John Rubinstein. About 7 months later, they fired Gil. Fred Anderson was interim CEO for a couple of months, and then Steve came back as interim CEO. Tom Suter. At the time, there was a Wired magazine cover with the Apple logo on it and one word. It said, "Pray." That was the dire straits that Apple was in. Everybody said, "Oh, they have like 90 days of cash left. They're going to die." Andy Hertzfeld. This is a little subtle and hard to understand, but Steve couldn't have come back to Apple without the Pixar success. That enabled it because it gave him the ability to not put everything on the line with Apple. Remember, when he came back, he wouldn't take the CEO job. Wayne Goodrich. Steve was the iCEO. Trip Hawkins. When Steve came back, he was a different Steve. He had grown up a lot. But he could still bring it on in terms of insanely great creative thinking. Mike Slade. The first thing he did was a classic judo move. The Think Different campaign was brilliant because it gave people permission to feel different and to feel good about the 2% market share that spring. Michael Dewey. Jobs spent a month going around to see what were all the projects running at Apple. He decided to go back to a simple product line because Apple at that time had a ridiculous number of products. The Macintosh had like 20 slightly different versions or something. It was just nuts. John Rubinstein. We convinced Steve that we should do a network computer. Michael Dewey. The idea was, so what if we gave you a box and all you do is plug it into the internet and you're on the